I'm here this morning with Mr. Bruce Hales of Mission Terminals at his office at 360 Main Street. And it is April 3rd, 2009. Nancy Peroso is conducting the interview. So perhaps, Mr. Hales, we could just start with your introducing yourself and your current position.
I'm Bruce Hales, currently chairman of Mission Terminal. I was the person responsible for the beginning of Mission Terminal back in 1999, and since that time we have been developing and adding staff, and so I'm currently in this position as chairman. We as a company are about to reform, rename the company, which takes in three, four other divisions of a group of companies owned by Upper Lake Shipping out of Toronto, Ontario. This is commencing the end of this month, and at that time we will be having a new CEO and president of the new company, Sumat Incorporated. That's the beginning. There'd be a great deal more detail as to how we commenced in Thunder Bay, and Thunder Bay is a very important part of our operation. We have the one terminal there that has the capacity to handle 110,000 ton storage. And in this past year of 2008, we passed through about 1,200,000 tons. So our interest in Thunder Bay is very extensive, and our development there, I think, has been very, very opportunist for the city of Thunder Bay. We've been able to hire, presently we have 35 people on our payroll, all gentlemen that were on layoff from some of the other terminals in the city at the time we started up. So they're happy, we're happy.
Just going back to the start of Mission Terminals, you said that was in 1999?
Yeah.
How did that come about?
Well, came about through, I guess, my interest in Thunder Bay and knowledge of Thunder Bay over the years previously. We were aware of the terminal that we now own. Over the years, it was a terminal that had been closed by one of the companies in Thunder Bay, and was owned by an individual who was using it for a wood pellet manufacturing plant. He got into financial difficulties, and the city of Thunder Bay then decided that they were going to have a tax sale on this terminal, and we at that time took a look at it and passed it by our legal people and discovered that yes, it was a working plant, and so we put a bid in to the city on this tax sale basis, and we were fortunate enough to be the successful bidder.
Now, the name Mission Terminal, where did that come from?
Well, that was originally our companies, most of our companies had a relationship in name to the Great Lakes, of which we, as a shipping company, have a lot of a lot of vessels that move grain up and down the Great Lakes system, including the St. Lawrence. And so we were going to use that, but we found that there was the names were not available, so we finally came up, and we the elevator is on the Mission River, and so it made a little sense to me anyway that we should just call this Mission Terminal. Mm-hmm. And that's how the name came about.
And I've seen the elevator. In fact, I visited the offices there. It's a beautiful setting. That was the Searle elevator, wasn't
yes,
it, at one time?
Yes, way back.
Were
yes.
they the first owners, do you know?
Yes.
Okay. It's hard to keep track of
yes.
who
and,
owned which
and
elevator
then
there.
The Searle Grain disappeared, were merged into other corporations, and this terminal ended up being owned by Saskpool, Saskatchewan Wheat Pool.
Okay. So you started to mention the company and Upper Lake Shipping. I don't know how easy it is to sort of give us an overview of the pieces of the company.
Well,
into which Mission Terminals fits.
Upper Lake Shipping commenced business in 1932, and primarily it was an Eastern company out of Toronto and involved in supplying milling wheat to the local flour mills throughout Ontario. In that development, of course, they decided that the way to move the grain prompted them to buy their own vessels, which were pretty small back in those days. This is before the Welland Canal, before the St. Lawrence Seaway. And the company did have a terminal, an elevator in the port of Ontario, Toronto, and it, from that, and at that time they had a connection with the original Maple Leaf Flour Mill Company, from that they developed into Eastern Canada, into the Quebec, Three Rivers, Quebec area, to supply flour to the province of Quebec, and also to get into the domestic feed grain business, which Maple Leaf were very involved with at the time. And so this is the connection that started to the company built a 140,000 ton transfer elevator in the port of Trois-Rivières, Quebec, and from that, the marketing grain company, you know, since this 1932 date.
Mm-hmm. Was it a public company or?
No, it's a private, and still is a private company.
And are there families, family names involved with it?
The Leach family, Gordon Leach was the father that started the company, and his son, Jack Leach, J.D. Leach, is still the chairman of the board of Upper Lake Shipping, and they call themselves now Upper Lakes Group because they have these other divisions, subdivisions, that are not in just shipping business. And we have, you know, this grains group, which consists of Mission Terminal, the elevator at the port of Trois-Rivières, and a company called Le Grand Lac Superior, which is the marketing company in Quebec, the elevator in Laviolette Stevedore and Company in the port of Trois-Rivières. The company has a ship repair business. One of the offices, one of the workshops, is in the port of Thunder Bay, and also in Eastern Canada, in St. Catherine area, on the Welland Canal.
The one in Thunder Bay, I think, is just recent, is it not?
Well, that company has been there for some years. I think the restructuring has taken place in recent years, in that there has been more repair work being done, and that branch of Upper Lakes is also attempting to broaden out somewhat in their manufacturing, and I think they're involved in an area, tank supplies and things of this nature. So the company is and has been diversifying and growing in these other areas, and that's where we are today.
We were talking before we were taping about the fact that your roots in the industry go quite deep, so I'm going to step back and just talk to you about that and then move into your own career. So Charles E. Hales was your dad.
Yes.
What can you tell us about him and his involvement in the grain industry?
Well, he was he came from Redding, California, up into Canada, and I'm not all that familiar with his activities. I know that he resided in Saskatchewan for several years, but then came to Winnipeg. Yes, but that goes back many, many years. And but he came to Canada, and when I look at he became made application to be a member of the Winnipeg Grain Exchange, which is now the Commodity Exchange. But he was mentioned in this that he was with a company, a security company in Winnipeg, and his application is 1922, and he states on here that previous to that 1922 he'd been in Winnipeg for 8 years, and prior to that he was Warner Grain Company in Winnipeg for 2 years. And this is an application that he put in on behalf of Dominion Elevator Company Limited. The Dominion Elevator Company was a company that was, and for Manitobans, it's interesting that the I don't want to rattle these pages, but the names of the members of this firm were Sir R. P. Roblin, who is a well-known Manitoban premier and goes done many, many great things, and another person by the name of McMillan, W.W. McMillan, and R.R. Muir. Those be gentlemen I do not. Fred Phillips, I think, was I think that's a lawyer that was involved here in Winnipeg for many years. And a Hugh Phillips. But that indicates how far with this company, Dominion Malting, now, or not Dominion Malting, but Dominion Elevator Company. Now, I know the Dominion Elevator Company had a group of elevators in Manitoba, Saskatchewan, and I think they probably numbered around 20 elevators, very small elevators at the time, the horse and buggy days almost, small truck operations. But this Dominion Elevator Company had two terminals in the port of Fort William and Port Arthur, one in Port Arthur, one in Fort William. They operated for several years, quite a few years. They were the old wooden elevators. So that was really my father's beginning. He was well thought of within the grain industry. In managing this company, Dominion Elevator, he was very much involved in the general trade operations. At that time, there was a Canadian Wheat Board that was just developing and their operation. And I know my father was very involved as a member, along with other members of the grain trade, in meetings with the Wheat Board as a group to try and develop better ways of marketing and moving the grain. At the same time, my father was involved in, quite involved in Fort William, Port Arthur, in negotiating with the union, that were involved with these terminals that were in place at that time. And, he, in looking back on his obituary that was written up in the paper, that he was highly thought of within that grain trade, and also was involved in some other activities. He was very involved in an organization that were promoting forestry throughout the prairies, and I think I'm not sure what it's called today, but I think this forestry organization is still there and still promoting, you know, the need for trees and that sort of thing.
Did he have any stories to tell about those early days, the trials and tribulations, the successes?
Well, a group of grain persons that would go over to visit with the Wheat Board and advise them and agree to methods of operation, that they would all sit around the table and they would say, oh yes, that makes good sense. And then as he related, that they would all go back to their offices and phone up the Wheat Board individually and say, oh, ignore what I was mentioning there. So, and that's, you know, that's sort of, the grain trade were forever attempting to, you know, find their way and preserve their ability to operate their own businesses. And I do know that there were, and still is, some great differences of opinion as to whether the Wheat Board should be there or should not be there, and their attempts to disbar or rid the country of the grain, of the Canadian Wheat Board.
The early setting up of labor relations with the unions, did your dad have anything to say about that as far as you recall?
No, he spent a lot of time at it. I do recall that, and that's back in the days where the passenger train was, and he was quite regularly hopping on that train overnight to Thunder Bay or to Port Arthur, Fort William, to have sessions with mm-hmm. With the union, and he pretty much did that on his own. The other grain companies said, "Okay, Charlie, you handle this on our behalf." So. And I do recall that he and I don't know the union to me, but I do know that they spent a long sessions together, mm-hmm. and nighttime as well.
Yeah, I'm not sure if it would have been Frank Mazur at that time.
It could have been, yes. But,
legendary figure
in
Thunder Bay.
Thunder Bay,
yeah.
Well, so, that could be who he was dealing with,
yeah.
If he goes back far enough.
Yeah.
And it was a one-on-one.
Yes.
Sort of a negotiation.
Oh, a lot of.
And,
yeah. Seemed to be so much dependent on personalities and an ability to be flexible.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's exactly what. And I think, too, that a lot of it was done sort of around the table, just the two of them having a little dinner, a little mm-hmm. sip of refreshment.
grain-based Dominion Company. Was that where he spent his career then, with Dominion?
No. Dominion sort of came together and eventually, and I don't really have all the back detail on it, but it became the Canadian Consolidated Grain Company. And that Canadian Consolidated Grain Company ended up, you know, Dominion was part of it, and there was another grain, small grain company, and they merged together. And at that time, my father, being the manager of the Dominion, I guess became then the president or manager of this Canadian Consolidated Grain Company. And that's the company that I started into the grain business with.
Okay. Did your dad travel at all, other than to Thunder Bay to negotiate? Did he do any traveling on behalf of the company at all?
Well, it was a Manitoba, Saskatchewan company, and of course he traveled extensively throughout the company and its operation, and into the Thunder Bay. He was not... He was not traveling overseas or down. He was involved once in a while in dealing with the government, and of course would then end up in Ottawa.
For one of the many inquiries, or
that's right. Back in those days, there were royal commissions going on. Several of those were taking place, and I know that my father was very involved in the dealings within those. And some of that history is interesting to read back on. And there were many issues.
Yes. Railways.
Well, a railroad, get back to it, with only the two railroads that we have in this country, that we had a czar of transportation, fellow by the name of Milner, and it was his duty to make sure the railroads performed in the transportation of grain. And the railroads at that time had to pay very close attention to what this gentleman was telling them that they should be doing. And today we read also of where the grain industry are somewhat concerned at times with the service that's being provided to the grain industry. So, and I think, you know, we have a Department of Transportation, but we don't have that one individual who is, this is big country, and railroads are very, very important to it all.
So when you were mentioning that you started with Consolidated,
right?
Correct. How old were you at that time?
I was 19.
Did you ever travel before as a child? Did you ever travel with your dad down to Thunder Bay?
No, I never went on those kind of trips.
No. So what was your first introduction to Thunder Bay?
Well, I went with the company, and of course they sent me out to a point in Ely, Manitoba, to become to train as a grain buyer. And you know, I spent a year doing that, and then came back into Winnipeg, and they decided that I should learn how to inspect grain. Those little ventures. And I've forgotten just the year it was, but there was our manager in Thunder Bay, in Port Arthur, Fort William, was ill and had to take 6 months off. And so at that time, they sent me to Thunder Bay to oversee the operation down there, of which at that time I knew nothing about. And all I recall of that venture was that these were wooden elevators and wooden pulls to open the open the bins, and they were interesting operations, but they did work. And
about what year would that be?
Well, that would be,
so it'd be about, you were about 20.
50.
I'm only familiar with the concrete elevators in Thunder Bay. So can you remember where the consolidated elevators were, the wooden ones?
Well, Fort William was, as I remember it, the hydro plant on, I guess that's Mission River.
Yes, on the island.
On that, what would that be, the north side of the river? That river runs.
Yes,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And that was the Fort William. And the Port Arthur.
So it was, where was it in relation to the hydro plant?
Well, it was about that location.
Oh, really?
Port Arthur was where the AgriCorps, the United Grain Corps.
UGGM, beside Saskatchewan,
yeah.
Pool 7?
Yeah, it was in that area.
Okay. Now, there was a Thunder Bay elevator there, a little
yes,
one.
Yeah.
Then there was UGGM.
There was a McCabe. Well, McCabe.
That was UGGM, I think.
Yeah.
McCabe started out as McCabe.
Yeah.
So where was it in relation to McCabe?
Well, that was about that location.
Okay.
It was right that
right
area.
Around there.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I think they tore them down and put up the concrete.
Right. Well, eventually
which
we'll get
now
this.
Pulling down some of the concrete.
Oh, I know. Yes, they become events
mm-hmm.
as they take them down. Our project's called Elevators Up and Down, so.
Yeah.
Any first remembrances about going to Thunder Bay other than, gee, this is new?
Well, that's
so
primarily.
You lived there then?
I stayed in Fort William at the
mm-hmm.
YMCA.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes.
It's being torn down.
Yes, it should be, too. And that was quite an adventure. The old hotel, was it the Royal Alexander?
Royal Edward.
Edward, yes, yes. And
they didn't really put you up at Spiffy Diggs then.
No. Well, I don't know that there were too many Spiffy Diggs right at that time. But no, that's my recollection. I recall, you know, through the winter time, we'd get that freezing rainstorm event sometimes, and it would take you about an hour to chip the ice off the car and so that you could see out of it. But other than that, it was a beautiful, I used to move around a little bit, and I knew a couple of people there, and of course was involved in some social activities, which was of interest at the time. And but, you know, the trip going back and forth to Fort William and Port Arthur at that time could be an adventure.
In what way?
Well, in just that it seemed like a long way over the road. It isn't today, but at the time, you kind of had to venture down out of Fort William and go around in a few little bends and circles to get across to Port Arthur.
Well, I'd imagine that the bridges that are there now weren't there at the time
you
were there.
I think the ones over
to the elevators.
Yeah. Well, yes. Yeah. No, that's all changed certainly
mm-hmm.
to what it was then.
Mm-hmm. So, what were those elevators like? Like what? Just. Describe them as you remember them.
Well, they were, built completely out of wood, and the bins were all wooden. I can't recall how many bins were there, but the The design of the elevators was similar to what you see today in concrete. You have a workhouse, you have the bins, you have the elevator system, and you have the trackage, and everything's just somewhat larger than what it was back then.
And a lot more workers, I would assume?
Well, I'm not sure about that because, you know, when I think back on, and I haven't paid that much attention to it recently, as to the staff of, you know, the Viterra now and Richardson, I think they have a lot of employees at those terminals. And back in those other days, I would think probably had 30, 40 people.
A lot more shoveling grain.
Oh, yes, there was a lot more physical, and of course the unloading of the boxcars was, they had boxcar dumps back in those days, and, which is quite very different to what we see today with the hopper car operations.
And what about the ships coming into those
terminals? Well,
they
were all smaller ships, of course, at that time. Today they're taking out 27,000 tons of grain on a ship. Back in those days, if it took 5,000 to 6,000 tons, it was a fairly good load. Until the Seaway commenced, we did not have large ships on the Great Lakes.
So what would be your most endearing memories of, was it a year in Thunder Bay?
Yes.
That was your penance, other than staying at the YMCA? What sticks with you the most from that experience?
Well, I guess it was the learning experience. I did not travel outside of the Thunder Bay area at that time. My spent time there was really through the winter, so, and I remember there was a fair amount of snow through the winter, that winter. So traveling around was somewhat restricted. The fascination of it was, the ships, the activity in the grain end of it. I do recall that hockey was a very high sport in Thunder Bay at the time, and the YMCA, they used to, that every Friday night, I guess it was, they'd have a dance. And that was rather interesting to attend that.
Did you have contact with the other elevator companies in Thunder Bay at that time?
Not really, no. I've had contact, of course, with the Grain Commission, who were close by our downtown Fort William office. So the grading aspect of that, the samples and so forth, but as to relationship with other grain companies, no.
Mm-hmm. Where were the offices, do you recall?
Offices? Well, they were right adjacent to the YMCA.
Okay.
It was sort of in the heart downtown Fort William.
In the Chapels building?
I believe so, yeah.
Okay, because the Grain Commission was in that building at that time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, we were in, we were in the Chapel building.
You could just roll out of bed and take a few steps and you were there.
Well, that's right.
I'm going to step back because I'm interested in your early career, even before your stint in Thunder Bay. So you went out to Ely, Manitoba,
right,
to learn to become a grain buyer.
Right.
And what are your remembrances of learning to be a grain buyer?
Well, it was interesting, hard work, and that physically hard work, and that back in those days they were boxcars, and of course boxcars had to be coopered, and the coopering was the closing of the boxcar doors with lumber and tar paper and a lot of hammering. And then of course when you were loading a boxcar you had to do a lot of shoveling to get the grain from the doorway back into the ends of the boxcar. So, and it was dusty and hot work through the summertime. Mm-hmm. So
the name Buyer really doesn't quite say it all.
No. They did call them assistant buyers and buyers, but no, that's.
So where did the buyer part come in?
Well, that was at the elevator doorway when the farmer delivered his grain to the elevator, and it went into the pit to go into the elevator storage. That at that stage the samples were taken of the grain being delivered, and a grade was put on it, and a price at that time was put on it. So that's the buying. A cash check was delivered to the farmer in return for the grain that he delivered. And it was pretty automated to that extent. It was all, you know, Green Shield bookkeeping, but...
What's Green Shield bookkeeping?
That's the gentleman that used to sit around an office in the high chairs and at the desks and had their eye shade.
So that's the Green Shield part of it?
So
you were associated then with the Consolidated had a country elevator in Ely?
Oh, yes. Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. That was one of the areas throughout Manitoba, with several of them at that stage, and Saskatchewan as well. Mm-hmm. I recall the rail to visit our elevators in Saskatchewan. And, that was always an interesting time. And of course, you'd stop off in the town, the little village that where the elevator was, and you'd get off the train, go to the hotel, and you'd book in. And if you wanted hot water in the morning, you had to circle the time you were going to be up, and different to mm-hmm. what we see today.
Yeah. So your dad encouraged this sort of starting?
Oh yes, that was all part of my training to get out. And
I imagine it served you well.
Well, I hope so. It was interesting times. And, that's fun to think back on some of those little trips and times.
Mm-hmm. Any difficulties, or was it?
Not the breakdown and that sort of thing. But when I think back on it, we always read of the odd elevator agent, the buyer that would sort of fall off the wrong side of the track and be stealing a little grain here and there. But I never experienced that in my time. I know other elevator companies had that once in a while.
The interaction with the farmers, did you experience much of that when you were there?
No. You would be in relationship with them if they were delivering when you were there, but I don't recall in my times out there, I wouldn't be out in necessarily the busiest part of the season because the elevator buyers they're rather busy at that time. So
to train you opposed to you just being underfoot.
Time to talk to me. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So. The were there other competitor elevators in Ely?
Yes. They say, I think UGG were in Ely at that time. UGG, of course, is no longer United Grain Growers. But I think that was the only other competition in that. But, you know, the next little town over, you'd have the Manitoba Pool. I don't recall Cargill at the time. I guess it would be National Grain back in those days. And I don't recall we being up against them. It was more either Manitoba Pool or UGG in Manitoba, and Saskatchewan Pool in and UGG in Saskatchewan.
What made the difference between whether the farmers delivered to you or to UGG?
I think it was the I think it was the grain buyer. It was the fellow that you had responsible for running the operation in that town, and if he was a good boy and got along well with them all in the beer parlor, that would attract the grain in. And of course the company had to be respected, and to gain that respect you had to provide good service and good prices but primarily you had to have that personality of the buyer to attract the farmers. Again, a little different to what you see today, but again, today your man on the scene is...
If I recall correctly, then you moved from your stint out there into, went back into Winnipeg to work in grading and inspection. What do you recall about what you learned there? And
well, my position with the company back in Winnipeg was really, I was involved. We were promoting chemical products for the farmer to rid himself of weeds in his field, and I recall that I was involved in that development of that side of the business in the company. But primarily, my job was to at that time samples were all stopped and taken here in Winnipeg and then delivered to the in the old Grain Exchange building to the commodity to every morning, and each company had their own little spot in the inspection room to look at all the samples coming through on any given day, and in doing that the inspector had the responsibility of at that time you could select protein by visually, just by kind of looking at the color. And so you would, you would advise the terminal at unload to set that aside, because protein, as it is today, is got a value to it. And so that was part of the job then. And of course, any barley shipments, we were always busily trying to pick off malting barley samples and car lots that could be again set aside and delivered to the malting companies of the day. And so that was a big part of it.
We had talked to Mr. Duke, who was the chief grain inspector at the Grain Commission. He was telling us about the change when they used to sample here. Two questions that we discussed with him. And one we weren't certain of the answer to, so maybe you know. We were wondering where the CN yards were at that point. I think we sort of decided they might have been at near Jubilee, Fort Rouge.
I think they were, yeah. I didn't go near the yards, CP is sort of
the Weston area, right. The other thing was... what impact, if any, the change in process there of not sampling in Thunder Bay had on the companies. Did it make any difference that, you know, you weren't...
Not sampling in Thunder Bay?
Not sampling in Winnipeg and instead having it unload at the elevator.
No, I don't recall that changing anything particularly. No, that change really took place when I was more involved in the shipping business on the Great Lakes. So I didn't really follow it that closely. I was out of, you know, sort of the grain handling business, elevator business.
So from that stint with the inspection and grading, that was when you went to Thunder Bay for your experience at the terminal, and then what direction did your career take?
Well, then, you know, the my father died, and the company was taken over by, it was bought out by United Grain Growers, and at that time I didn't see too much of a, Grain Growers were quite a large company. Saw an opportunity to get into the cash grain business as a broker in Winnipeg on the grain exchange trading floor.
So how does that work? What did that entail?
Well, that entails at that time, grain companies used to, you know, the elevator terminals would have would be blending grains to get a better grade, or they'd have off-grade grains that, you know, your one-feed screenings, your refuse screenings, and things of that kind. There'd always be a need to be buying and selling, you know, a one-feed barley to make a two-feed, or a two-feed to make a one-feed. And that's really what the cash grain business consisted of. You had to go around elevator companies, terminal companies, not as it is today where you're down to three, four. So, you know, that was the cash grain business that, you know, you'd, and in those days, grain could be bought, your barleys particularly, and oats, were traded by the grain companies. The Canadian Wheat Board were not involved in that transaction. So you would, you know, the malting, when this malting barley was selected and stored in the terminals, then the elevator company would have it there and want to make a sale on it. And you would be approaching the elevator company, terminal company, to sell it on behalf of a buyer, a malting of grain traded that way. And there's a cash grain business. There's not at back in those days, there were probably 9 or 10 cash grain brokers. The volume supported that. Today, I think there's only one.
Now, what is a cash grain broker?
Well, he's the fellow who goes between buyer seller and tries to promote, in some cases, promote a trade of that grain, or if the terminal has need to sell, then rather than he go to directly to a buyer, he would go through a broker, because oftentimes they would not want their participation known in the trade until after the trade was made.
And why would that be?
Well, if a buyer knows who the seller is, that would give the buyer some advantage because of some other knowledge that he had of what was happening in the industry. And So there was a need for confidentiality in the trades that were going on. And even oftentimes the buyer seller would not want the trade known to the rest of the trade,
mm-hmm.
because that's giving their positions away. And that was, you know, a big part of the need for a cash grain broker.
And what has changed? You said it went from close to 10 down to 1.
The change has just come about through a lack of, there's not as many grain companies as there once was. There's not as many grain buyers. The old grain exchange, the floor of the grain exchange trading, and they're all representing 20 different companies, 20 to 30 different companies. As time went on and as the trade changed, and a lot of it was brought on with the wheat board influence, the number of companies disappeared. They merged. Some just went out of business. At one stage on the floor, there would be 20 exporters represented. And, there's the offshore buyer that they would have a representation here in the city of Winnipeg, looking after their overseas needs on behalf of their owners. And, of course, that in itself created a lot of trade between these companies, and they're all sort of competing against each other, and that how the commodity exchange first became necessary back in the days when the regulation was not as it is today. And, buyer seller had sometimes difficulty finding each other.
Mm.
And so that's why they came together in this marketplace.
When I think about the changes in the broad industry and the impact of the wheat board and the change in the production, different types of crops that are grown now in greater amounts than previously. So, for example, wheat used to the prairies produced.
And still is. Still is.
So that I could certainly see when the wheat board came in then that would make quite a difference in the makeup of the...
Well, the wheat board, when it first came in, Bennett, way back in 1935, he's the one that said we need to have a wheat board, and that was sort of the beginning of some regulation. And the conservative government back in those days was they weren't exactly as we hear from them today, that they're all for private trade and free enterprise and so forth and so on. Back in those days, they were more protectionist than. And as I remember in conversations with my father in those days, that the liberals were the ones that were the free trade. And things have kind of reversed. And, I oftentimes looking at the business today and think back to those days and how it was then and the change in government positions, the government has more control of things today than they ever had back in those days. But the wheat board was brought in. There was need for it. The companies were not as regulated as they could have been and should have been. And so there were, and this went on right up into the 40s and 50s.
What were some of the situations that made it necessary to have that regulation?
I think it was a they had control of the farmer had only one place to go with his grain, And he had five or six buyers of the grain out there, but they weren't all in the same town. Oftentimes, and I do recall one time on the grain exchange, the floor of the grain exchange, at the market close every day, the grain companies that were buying the farmers' grain in the country, they would establish between them what they were going to be paying the next day in the country. And I remember the competitions people came to the grain exchange and brought these grain companies to the fore and said, cease and desist, this, you can't do this anymore. And so, you know, there were those kind of things that were going on. And the poor old producer, and it's the same thing today, the producer really needs a friend. And the friend at the moment, and has been for the last 30 years, I guess, has been the Canadian Wheat Board. And I recall, and I look back on when I became the chairman of the Commodity Exchange, and the write-up in the newspaper, and I read back on my thinking at the time. My thinking has changed quite considerably since those days.
Has it? So can you?
Well, back in that time, and I thought
that would have been about what year?
Well, that would be back in 77.
Okay.
78. But at that time, you know, I felt that there was a place for the private grain trade to have a little more say in the buying of grain from farmers. And I felt there was a way that you could see a dual market between the Wheat Board and the private grain trade. But my thinking today is that, well, that's impossible because there's only three major buyers in the country of producers' grain. You've got Viterra, you've got Richardson International, you've got Cargill, you've got Patterson and B&H on the border, but very small related to these others. These others are handling 70% of the grain in the country. And as such, that is not sufficient competition to give a good, straight, honest service to the grain producer. And that's the role that the Wheat Board, and under their pooling system, can control.
And the dual system that they talk about?
The dual system won't work because the Wheat Board have no facilities. They don't own any facilities, so they would have to, if a farmer wants to sell to the Wheat Board, it still has to go through the facilities of these other three companies. And you know, when the board come to ship or sell against the same customer that these grain companies are going to be selling against, Who's gonna service who? I don't see these grain companies giving the first position to the Canadian Wheat Board under those conditions, unless you had a regulator that you know, a czar that came in and said this is the way it's going to be. But it, you know, the two just don't work together. And the other weakness, I think, of getting rid of the Canadian Wheat Board is that the Wheat Board come up with some pretty good value price-wise for farmers. You know, having the control of the sale of wheat, as they do have, allows them to seek out and retrieve some premiums that the other international companies, Richardson or are a Canadian company. Viterra cannot be considered a Canadian company as it once was as Sasspool. It's owned by the Americans, and of course you have Cargill, owned by Americans. And so, you know, where's the priority in selling Canadian grain going to be? It's going to be where these companies can make the greatest margin. And that isn't always going to be the Canadian situation. Or if it is, then the farmer is going to be receiving a whole bunch less for his grain than should be. So,
we're an hour into the interview. Would it be a good time to take a pause?
Well, if, sure.
just a sec. I don't think I started it.
I didn't hear the...
No. We're okay. We're just coming back after a stretch break, and Mr. Hales, if you would just comment on the life of a grain broker, in particular your memories of trading on the commodities exchange.
Well, the grain exchange back in the 40s and 50s was probably made up of 100 members, 100 plus, I guess, all of whom would come together at the opening of market on the trading floor to either trade cash grain or trade futures, futures being their hedging of grain they had purchased or sold in the country. In order to do this, of course, there were 7 or 8, 9 cash grain brokers on the trading floor. There'd probably be 30 or so futures brokers standing in either the barley pit, wheat pit at the time. The activity could be certainly, depending on market conditions, could be rather exciting. The futures trades, the buying and selling of the futures, was always recorded visually to those on the trading floor through a price board system, in that when a trade was made, it was reported to the board marker, and then that was immediately shown on written onto this marketing board.
In chalk?
In chalk, in those days. Now that eventually became electronic and was done automatically as the trades were spoken out and spoken through. It would automatically relate up onto this pneumatic board. But as I think I mentioned earlier, that you know, of these members on the trading floor, they all represented the grain companies, or they represented export houses, buyers, offshore buyers. They represented malting companies, flour mills were always very much involved, and at that time Canada had quite a few flour mills, so there was quite an activity there. The cash grain brokers would go to buyer seller and try and promote if they had an idea of, or if they knew of some position that somebody had, and they'd try and promote a grain trade beneficial to both parties. The futures, of course, were primarily the grain companies that had purchased the cash grain in the country and had to, if they did not have a sale for it at the time, then they had to put a futures position in place. They had to protect themselves from price fluctuation. So it was an active kind of a system. In the 40s, 50s, the Canadian Wheat Board were certainly involved, and they had wheat and barley, and they were active at that time in, not in the wheat market, but certainly in the barley market, in hedging their position, country position, that through their pooling system that they were taking on. And so there was a great deal of volume trading that was taking place. There'd be, I don't know, back in those days it was bushels, so it wouldn't be surprising to have a million bushels trade in one snap kind of a pricing commitment. And that all started to change, and I guess we should talk somewhat of what happened to the grain exchange. The grain exchange was firstly started up for the need of price protection and price discovery. Then, of course...
Now, for those of listeners who wouldn't know what price discovery and price protection were, is there a simple explanation?
well, price protection is, as I had mentioned, that grain price, and so he says it's worth a dollar. Now the grain company, because it's still back in the elevator system, has no way of providing that to a buyer of that grain that same day or tomorrow. He can make a forward sale to him, and so then that's based on what he's paid for it on that day, and he calculates all his costs in so that he can pre-sell that or forward sale that. Now, if he can do that, then he does not need price protection through a futures market. If he's just buying and going long that grain, then he needs a system whereby he has a sale in the future for delivery. And of course, that's why these futures all had delivery months.
Right.
And in the of activity, and you'd see a lot of delivery. And the deliveries were taking place in Thunder Bay, in the terminals in Thunder Bay. Also, the same thing happened on the West Coast in Vancouver. That all changed. The delivery months were still there, but the delivery position was changed from the port position to country positions back in the country. So that kind of changed the usage of futures markets. A buyer, an overseas buyer, would want to ship in November. He'd buy October futures, get delivery in Thunder Bay, have his ship come in early November and ship it out. When the grain delivery is back in the country, that sort of eliminates that need. The pricing is it's quite a different position than what it was with delivery in ports. This was really, the busy time for the grain exchange and the commodity exchange was when you had that port delivery system in place. As that disappeared, then so did some of the need for futures trading, the need for cash trading.
How did the change come about? Why the shift from?
Well, it was the grain companies, the owners of the grain port facilities, one of the problems with a delivery system based on a delivery month, is that the grain sits there and is not shipped. The storage ends up back in the country. And, you know, the flow through the terminals is not sufficient to handle the volumes of grain that are there for sale. And that's really why that system did change around. As we started, I guess at one time, Canada used to, for export, we had 8,000 tons of grain for export, all grain. We had quite a lot of grain, but as that grew, and now we're up, 25 million tons, that's rather difficult on the system to handle. Now, we've seen these concrete elevators in the country grow, and there are more storage there, and there's a faster throughput, and if the rail service is there to keep up to it, then it's equated through a 12-month season, or 9 months as in Thunder Bay. And,
More flexibility then,
yeah,
in the change. Mm-hmm. So going back to the floor of the exchange, what would cause you, your heart to beat faster on the floor of the exchange?
Well, it was really the futures traders, and they were future brokers, and they'd be given an order by a company, depending on the company's position, to either buy or sell the future. And of course, a lot of this, because of having to price grain the next day, was always done at the close of market. And so you have a 5 minute sort of a period whereby, I don't know, there could be a sort of futures being sort of battered back and forth, and that got people's attention. That short period of time to finish the trade,
close the deal
on behalf of your buyer or seller.
And if you didn't close it?
Well, then sometimes the buyer seller might look for another broker.
So is it like a bidding up at that time? So you sort of have a range?
You had buys and sells. And yes, the order that you were given would have a limit to it. It wouldn't just be uncontrolled, but there would be some close orders that, mm-hmm. And of course this, the close could be driven up very highly, or it could be driven up down quite considerably, depending on whether there's more buyers or sellers at the time.
Is there a certain personality that does better?
I think there is, yes. Futures, yes. You have to have a quick mind and a quick mouth and a loud voice in order to be heard and get your... you have to be very aggressive.
Yeah. Were there certain, I don't know if we'll call them stars, but were there certain sort of...
There were better. Some
better
were than better than others, certainly.
So yeah. Were there, what's the word I'm looking for? Legends on the floor.
I would think so. And maybe in some of your other conversations, there were characters and became legends to some extent. Yeah, there were some considered to be and used to a greater extent than others.
And names come to mind?
Howie Stover is one that he was very prominent in futures trading. Grain companies had their own futures brokers. A lot of them had them, and they were pretty well established and qualified. And
Mr. Stover, who was he independent?
He was independent. Yeah. was a fellow, Bill Gall, and he was independent, and you know, they were different.
They were different. How would you say, describe different in
their case?
Well,
just, you know, not your ordinary banker type. Not a sit around the table quietly kind of individual. They had personality.
So the vision that I see of, you know, people yelling and screaming and you know, lots of activity, that is what it was like.
Oh yes, very much so. But in saying that too, unlike today, in saying that, that was all positive commotion because people were able to read markets a little better than, well, they can't read them today at all. You know, these major, some of the major companies, that trading pit operation was very fact-finding for, you know, even if one was not on that day trading, one could get a sense of what business was going on, which would help you in your next day trading. And that visual contact was very important, and the conversation that is available on a moment's kind of notice. You know, a trader or a grain company could go to any of those brokers and say, what's going on? And mm-hmm. he'd get a pretty good read. He wouldn't get names of but he'd have a good knowledge of what the buy-sell situation was for that given moment.
Mm-hmm. Now,
and you can't get that today with people sitting in their offices mm-hmm. looking at a screen for 24/7.
Yeah. So when you talk about a pit, like you were saying there'd be the barley pit. So that was sort of a location?
Yeah, it's a location.
Okay.
The trading floor had side by side two different pits, and they're steps down.
Mm. So it was a pit.
Yeah, mm-hmm. So that people could stand there and you know, either look up or look down.
And you would only go there if you had business that day.
Well, or people would oftentimes just, you'd see them just standing there listening.
Mm-hmm. Was there a when you were just observing?
Circular.
It was circular. So if you were, if you didn't have a trade to make,
well, you could stand outside the pit
and just watch the action.
Just watch the action. Yeah.
Well, we're going to have to call it for today because of my schedule. But I'd really like to continue at another day. Is that going to be possible?
We'll certainly give that a try. You bet.
Good.